My name is Peter, recovered alcoholic.
Peter.
Grateful to be alive and sober and part of a sacred place called Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you for calling me back here. I just did a 12-week step series here, and it's kind of like just when I thought I was out, they pulled me back in. Young folks have no idea what I'm talking about, the older guys do.
Oh, yeah.
June 23rd, 1988 is when God separated me from alcohol, and I'm very grateful to be a recovered member of a sacred fellowship. I'm really glad the holidays are over. Happy New Year to everyone. I'm glad that's out of the way. For me, I was sharing the other night, I guess maybe I'm getting older and sentimental. I just look at the importance of those holidays have been moved from religious communities to Macy's. I don't know how that happened. But I enjoy the getting together with friends or family and getting to my religious community. After that, it's pretty much a wash for me. So, but I was just sharing the other night, it's interesting. This year, what went on with me was incredibly grateful for the blessings God has given me, and very grateful for the nightmares He's removed from me, including the things I thought I needed to be happy. And I remember many, many years ago, it was about 3 or 4 days or so before Christmas, and I took my first arrest, and I completely ruined my family's Christmas. Because they were at one of my relatives' house, and the buzz in the air was, we got to get him a lawyer so he doesn't go to jail. My first arrest, I remember getting arrested that day and thinking I was going to get the electric chair. I was charged with possession and intent to sell or something, loitering, stole the thing. And until I got to the Tombs in New York and all the jailhouse lawyers were in there, they knew exactly what was going to happen to me. They were giving each other advice. And I'm sitting there going, but you're in here for the 20th time. You don't really have good advice. And I remember by the end of the night, I started off sitting on the bench in the cell, afraid to move. And somewhere by the end of the night, I was kind of hunkered down under the bench on the concrete floor, and they brought out these like cheese sandwiches on stale bread. It was an interesting menu that night. And I got to see the judge, and I was released ROR. And when I went out, they brought me out, and there was my dad and both of his brothers. My dad at the time was a pretty, he'd intimidate you with his look. And his brothers were bigger than him. And I remember thinking, take me back into the Tombs. I'm safer in there because I know the music I have to face as soon as I get released from this thing. And that was the start of many arrests. And I think it's only because of my dad's money and his connections that I never went away. But I kept getting in trouble. One New Year's Eve, I remember, you know, back in Brooklyn, what they used to do back in the day, New Year's Eve at 12 o'clock, they'd light fireworks, people come out of the house, when people talked before cell phones, we actually spoke to each other, and they'd bang pots and pans and hit the horns, and I'm in the streets thinking who I can rip off, what car I can break into to steal a radio, what car I can steal, I mean, all of these, what house I can get into. This is what's going on because I'm broke, desperate, I need a drink. And it was just an accumulation of many things that got me to a point of, I can't do this anymore, but I continue to do it. And there were many times along the journey into hell that I knew I was in serious trouble. I knew I needed to do something about this drink problem. I got addicted to non-conference approved dry goods. So I got these two-headed monster devouring my life, and I know I need to do something. And I had been through treatment centers, and they talked about 12-step fellowships, but that seemed a little radical and extreme. There's somehow, some way, I can control and manage this. And then I got to a point where I know I need to stop all of this, and I came up with the reality that I didn't have the power to stop it, even when I wanted to. And what my mind would do over and over and over again, and it'll happen to me in sobriety, that it'll pay any price tomorrow to seek comfort right now, whatever that is. Because even in recovery, what alcoholism does, because I have alcoholism, not wasm, what it will do is go underground and resurface in other areas. They will be a food spree, which I developed an eating disorder my first year. I was binging and purging all the time and developing this thing with food. It will be a food spree, a sex spree, a money spree, a fear spree, a gambling, some sort of spree, an anger spree. And what many of us know about is the thinking spree, because we're always thinking, always trying to figure stuff out. And then it'll resurface in one of those, and eventually a double vodka is waiting for me. As long as I think I can run the show, as long as I think I can figure it out in a place called self-reliance, what I'm doing is relying upon the old insane mind to fix the insane mind. And for me, a form of insanity is not only that I never picked up the first drink drunk, but being sober, going back to me to figure stuff out, because that's where the main problem centers. And my years in and out of AA and in and out of treatment centers, I was under the delusion that my alcoholism came in a bottle of whiskey. That if I can just not drink, life is going to be fabulous. And I can do like those other people. I can get a job, report to the job, and buy stuff, and have a good life. And what I woke up to when I wasn't drinking, I was worse than when I was drinking. I had nothing to pour on my isms. And I was left with me and the hideous four horsemen, and life was coming at me. It was devouring me. And in recovery, if I'm not careful and I'm not working out in the AA gym, I start to look at life coming at me. I start to see life from where I am rather than as it is. And perceptions of situations cause me pain and suffering. My perceptions that come from a thinking mind, the predator. And I start to hear from the mind, I see from the mind, I speak from the mind, I act from the mind. And it's all fear-based, insecure, full of self-reliance, seven deadly sins. It's a warehouse of toxic stuff. And I operate out of that. What I begin to do in sobriety, I know I did it when I was out there, in sobriety is I inflict my woundedness upon you, and I operate out of a place of woundedness. About stuff that's not even happening anymore. I spent years in therapy. It was an incredible experience. But one day I woke up to, I'm talking about what's not happening anymore. Because my mind needs something to lock into. It needs to be entertained. It needs some sort of something to keep me going. And I come into Alcoholics Anonymous and I find out I'm still as delusional about life as I was when I was drinking, as I said, only in worse shape. And nothing to medicate myself with. And I was a raw nerve. And my first 6 months in Alcoholics Anonymous, I was completely Looney Tunes. The only thing I didn't go on was a money spree, because I had none. And thank God I didn't, because I might have, if I had enough money, I might have gotten drunk. I might have had enough money to fill up the tank and go. But I was experiencing all sorts of sprees, and I was in constant fear. I don't know if I said this enough, but just so you know, June 23rd, 1988 is when God separated me from alcohol. And what I've learned over the last 30 plus years, that if I don't have conscious contact with God, I'm in serious trouble. My first few years in Alcoholics Anonymous, if you ask me what's the most important thing in your life, I would tell you sobriety. And it's definitely a good answer. And it should be at the top of the list. But, you know, the truth is true until I discover a new truth, yeah? And for me, the most important thing in my life is conscious contact with God. Because when I have conscious contact with God, sobriety is taken care of. And my new truth is, if I say sobriety is a number one priority in my life, we hear all the time, somehow I just left God out of that equation, which means I'm keeping me sober. If I work hard enough, if I do enough things, if I make enough coffee, if I take enough commitments, if I pray enough, which is all good, there's a thick thread of I'm keeping me sober. Conscious contact with God, He's running the show. Conscious contact with God keeps me out of my own way. Conscious contact keeps a lid on those sprees I just talked about. Because if I have conscious contact with God, it must mean I'm in the trenches praying to God, communing with God, operating out of God, not just praying, getting up off my knees, and my life does not look godly. It doesn't look like a prayerful walk. I don't have fidelity to God anymore. I pray just to check the boxes, get up off my knees, and I go from Moses to Rambo in a minute, yeah? And I'm going through the day as if I never made a meeting, as if I never prayed, and I have fear and resentments and gossiping all in the head, judgments, criticism, all going on. I'm taking a side. I can no longer be a contemplative because I'm taking sides. It's me against you and you're wrong. Anger insists I'm right until I walk into the AA meeting and say, how you doing? I'm wonderful. I'm absolutely wonderful. I'm owning all day. And I put on the AA game face for about an hour, then the meeting ends. I get in the car and I'm back to me again, which is an untreated alcoholic, full of self-reliance, driven by 100 forms of fear. My ego has reemerged, except when I'm in the meeting, I play it safe. Because what happens to a guy like me around here? Well, we know how to play it safe. We know what to say. We know how to be, would you like some coffee? I'll get you coffee. I don't want to get him coffee, but I know everyone's looking. So I'm a stage character all over again. In the meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, this is bondage, and it's an awful way to live. For me, and God has disciplined me, not better than anyone, but disciplined me to a spiritual life where practicing fidelity, having conscious contact with God, not that I don't make mistakes, but it's not bondage to self anymore. In fact, the awareness level gets to a point where on most days, you can hear self turning the corner. You can almost hear the mind starting to talk and starting to size up and starting to judge and starting to critique. Now, at the front end, there's no drink on that. But believe me, on the caboose, there's a big drink. So even though our book talks about permanent sobriety, it is a day at a time that I get to go to this God and surrender all things to this power called God. Because without it, what I have, what you have in front of you is a dry drunk who's about to be a wet one. And the thing about my alcoholism, I don't know if you identify with this or not, alcoholism will never announce its arrival. It's not like a wedding invitation like we're doing, save the date, so you get prepared on this date, we have a wedding to go to. There's nothing like that at all. It just kicks the door open like a SWAT team and off I go. And what I've watched a lot of folks, and I've heard enough stories, the same way I can go through the steps, I can go backwards through the steps. And I don't even know this is going on because alcoholism is so sneaky and so subtle. So where I am currently is having a life of prayer and meditation. And I take no credit for that, just the way God has disciplined me. On awakening, retire at night. And having conscious contact, turning in order to go out throughout the day. I do none of this perfect, but that's what I do. And I do my nightlies, I do my little inventories. I have a sponsor, Bob is on from St. Paul, Minnesota. He's a great sponsor. And I look back at all the men that have been put in my life as sponsors. They're giants for me. I've been very blessed. A lot of men I thought were heroes and they became my sponsor, who either left or about to leave a rich legacy behind them. And I get to get close to these men and listen to their guidance. And God has kept me small enough to be teachable. Because as soon as I say I know, I stop learning. I have an opportunity here to do two things. Continue to live my story and tell my story and live my story and stay in that story. Or I can live the life God has given to me. So when we do a talk like this, we talk about what it was like. That's the story. And different times you remember certain things, inspiration comes to you, and sometimes we look at all what it was like from a different angle. But what it's like now should be always changing and evolving. If I'm really living the life God has given me, one of abundance and freedom, of courage, strength, and direction, to surmount when life hits, like we're about to go into this new COVID, we're in it again. I thought it was, you know, it was over and everyone's getting sick and there's a lot of weird stuff going on out there. The whole planet's inside out. I don't know what's going on. How do I navigate through that? Well, how do I navigate when the boss you go to work just doesn't like you? How do I navigate when you go home and he or she says, I'm leaving? Or God forbid our children get sick. How do we navigate through difficult financial times? And how do we navigate through just the opposite when it's absolutely wonderful? On my own power, I will ruin everything. I'm the type of alcoholic, I'll be the only guy on 95 and create a traffic jam. Yeah? That's just what I do. I've said this from a million podiums, how many times I would be sitting on my couch, especially when I first moved down here. I'm in South Florida, oh my God. I remember swimming on Christmas on purpose, just to tell my friends up north, I'm on the beach, I'm swimming, it's Christmas. You know, looking out the window, there's palm trees. It's pretty down here. The weather is great. The palm trees are great. The job was great. The money was great. Everything was great. The relationship was great. I'm going, this is great. And then my mind hears me saying, that's great. And I says, hold on a second. And it throws something in there, like, how old are you now? Now I can say I'm 62, going to be 63. And it says, now how many more years do you think you got left? We need to go hiking, snorkeling, camping, fishing right now, make $1 million by midnight. And I go from bliss to bleak in about 30 seconds, and I'm pissed off at everybody. That's what the mind does. The very same mind that tells me it's going to fill a hole is the same mind that keeps digging a hole, and I listen to it over and over and over again. Someone's outside my circle going, what's wrong with you? It is the great predator. And yet we tell people, and they bring the body and the mind to follow. Why in God's name do I want my mind showing up, or your mind, or anyone's mind showing up anywhere? I am what I think, as a man thinks, so something like that. Imagine if I was everything I think, I'd be in detox. So this power that I found in Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm especially grateful for, and I will be transparent with you. There are times when I doubt it, when I have my moments of doubt and skepticism. Are you paying attention? When I think I know better than God. And that's when I go into prayer and start negotiating with God rather than surrendering to God. It's never good. Because eventually I run out of road, hit the wall, and then God speaks through the brick wall. Self-reliance doesn't work, and my ego wants to insist that I'm in self-reliance, insist that I listen to it. And like Satan is the great liar. And I'll buy it. Every once in a while I will buy it. And I can feel the world heavy. I'm not traveling light anymore. I grew up in Brooklyn, and I remember growing up in Brooklyn. I was born in 59, so I remember some of the 60s. And I definitely remember the 70s, one of the worst fashion eras before the 80s came in. I don't know what happened there. But I remember the 60s, and we had problems in our country. If any of you guys remember some of the stuff that was going on, there was something cool about the 60s. They were called hippies and rock and roll and Motown. And I remember everyone back in Brooklyn hung out on street corners back in the day. That's what we did, all the schoolyards. And I remember growing up and watching the older guys on the corner drinking beer, hanging out, listening to music, and flirting with the girls and roughhousing. On Saturday night, it was an event. You know, there anywhere from 15 to 30 guys hanging out in the corner with the girls, and music was happening. And then the 8-track thing came out, and everyone bought Frampton Comes Alive. That was a thing. I mean, it was a scene. Didn't go 45 yet. And I wanted to be like them because I saw the effect being produced in them when they drank alcohol. Because what was going on with me was quite the opposite. My mind owned me. The mind makes a great servant but a terrible master, and it owned me. It was my master. It told me everything, and none of it was good. I was a really gifted musician growing up, and no matter how many accolades I got, I knew I was still stuck with me. And once the applause stopped, I woke up to, I'm still me. And no matter where I went, there I was, and it wasn't good enough. I wasn't good looking enough, I wasn't strong enough, I wasn't tough enough, I wasn't tall enough, I just went on and on and on. I had a mom at home who committed suicide in January 23rd, 1974, and I grew up with this alcoholic mom. Bless her heart, she tried to do a great job, but she was addicted to alcohol and a lot of narcotics and a lot of suicide attempts. And in January 74, she finally did what she wanted to do and leave this walk. And I can't tell you, it was like the fist of Gavlin reached down and pulled out all the air out of my lungs that day. I remember my dad on the 911 call. This guy, never heard him cry, never saw fear in him once. And I woke up to hearing my dad weeping and screaming in terror, please come quick, I think my wife is dead. And I was literally in my lower bunk, frozen with fear that morning. It was like 4 o'clock in the morning, frozen with fear. I couldn't move. And I can feel my heart pounding like she did it. And I think at that point, although it wasn't a conscious decision, I don't want anything to do with God anymore. But that's what happened. I'm a cradle Catholic. And my mom took me to all the religious instructions and taught me how to pray. And made sure she told me how much the carpenter loves us, how much God loves us. He would never hurt us. But I'm watching her get sicker and sicker. And when she finally takes her life, I couldn't wrap my head around that at 14 years old. And I knew this God stuff was probably for women and children and Walt Disney cartoons. It's not real. I got to be like my old man. Just blaze right through life. Anything in your way, just hit it. I'd have the ability to do that. I was cast into the sea, as I like to say, of self-reliance. Figure it out as you go, like a lot of us. Until I drank this one night. And I grabbed a quart of beer. And I'd never been drunk before. I had some of my grandfather's homemade wine out. But my first drunk was on a street corner. And halfway through a quart of Colt 45 beer, I'm feeling absolutely wonderful. You know that warm feeling we get? It's just nice. That's why I go back to it. And the girls got prettier, I got better looking, I got taller, I had muscles. I was the don of the neighborhood by midnight. It was a cool thing. And when I finished the quart of beer, I'm drunk, but it was just a great drunk. I knew I was drunk, and I loved it. Why'd I wait so long? And on my way home, I remember this clearly. I don't ever want to be sober again. I'm 14 years old. I think of this 14-year-old kid now, you know, should be playing Little League Baseball and have the world right here. And I'm thinking, I don't ever want to taste sobriety again because I tasted the honey tonight. And it's interesting how I'm one of them. Many of us can identify with this. I don't realize how much bondage I'm in or had been in until I walk into a little bit of freedom. Like that bad relationship where, you know, a lot of us know what that feels like, what it sounds like. And then you get out and go, oh my God, how did I stay in that relationship that long? What was I thinking? That's the problem. I was doing a lot of thinking. And on my way home that night, this warm glow, I was wrapped up in this thing called alcoholism. I was lit up, the first drunk. I never want to be sober again. And I remember thinking, I'm not going to school on Monday drunk. I'm not going out. I want to go in lit up. And I pursued that. As our book talks about, to the gates of insanity and almost death. I wanted to capture that elusive feeling. I love the effect produced by it. No consequence, the first time I got drunk, I woke up the next morning sober, not hungover, but remembering everything. That was the hook. See, I took the bait. I didn't know there was a hook on it. I remember everything. I want to go back there tonight and repeat the same exact thing, and I'm going to get that warm feeling, and everyone's going to be doing what they're doing, and the music's going to be the same. Everything's going to be great. It was never, ever the same. I was in the hunt now, and always stuck in the more. You know what I mean? The more, I need more. Always stuck in more. We call it craving, the allergic reaction. I like the word more, because more of anything. I never tried that, but just give me six. And as Bill says in his story, his drinking assumed more serious proportions is exactly what happened to me. It's interesting how back then, and it will happen in Alcoholics Anonymous, how my thought life will create my current reality. If I'm not real careful in Alcoholics Anonymous, I start to back away from prayer, start to back away from meditation, start to back away from inventory and a sponsor. What happens is my thoughts become paramount. They become more important, paramount, more important, paramount than to God and my own life, to my own recovery. Because my stuff, I'm jammed up in my own stuff. I'm thinking about this stuff all the time, all the time. All I got going on is my stuff. And I think I have thoughts. This is the crazy thing about me as an alcoholic. I actually believe they're my thoughts. These are my thoughts. I'm stuck in my thoughts. I got to get rid of my thoughts. If they were really my thoughts and I like them, exchange them for good ones. I can't because they're hooked into me and I can't get out of them. It's like this entity that lays on me and I can't get out. Do you ever walk into a spider web and it's like kind of all over you? That's my thoughts. Somehow I think I can get unhooked. I can't. Not without God. And at 14 and 15 and 16, up until I walked into AA, and about a year in here, my thought life owned me. It was my current reality. Whatever it said, it showed up in my life. And I acted as if. Acted accordingly, I should say. Well, weekends, you know, progressed into drinking a lot. And I start to get into little fights on the street, arguments. I had this attitude. One guy told me, you're a well-balanced individual. You got a chip on each shoulder. As I'm walking around, you know, I don't have a mom. I don't get along with my dad. I'm kind of like this warrior rebel without a clue is what I was. But I'm trying to do life and figure it out. I'm petrified around women. When I hang out with the guys, I'm second-guessing everything I say and do, very self-conscious. The only time I was comfortable was playing drums in a band. It's the only time I was comfortable while that was happening. When it was done, petrified before I started, in it, good. When it was done, I was right back to me again. I'd rather just drink. And I will tell you, I blew up a music career because alcohol was paramount. To the point where I had to drink. I couldn't say, well, I'll drink later. I had to drink. You know what's really frightening about alcoholism? And maybe you can identify with this. I got to a point where no matter how much alcohol I put in my body, I couldn't get there anymore. I couldn't get liftoff. There was the times I was consuming an enormous amount of drugs with it. And at the end, I was gobbling Valium with drinking, and I could not get past me. No matter what went in, I was still stuck with me, and I knew it. I was like just sober. I felt sober all the time. Now, I'm drunk, but I felt sober. I couldn't get lift off anymore. It was the beginning of the end. Thank you, God, that I survived that. And like a coward, which is what I turned into, I stole from people who trusted me, that called family. And I started to take things that didn't belong to me. And I stole from my dad's checkbook one time, and I got caught stealing. And I used to forge his checks and go down to the local bodega. They'd cash him for me because they knew who he was. $20, buy beer. $20, buy alcohol. I got away with it. They didn't want him walking in. He's here. I knew nothing about checking statements. He found out and came looking for me and found me in Lower Manhattan in a car one day with this young lady I met the night before. So you know how it goes. You meet her drunk, I'm in love now. And love and stalking for people like us are the same thing. I mean, you know how that goes. And my dad found me and put me in my first treatment center. Now, neither one of us knew what treatment was. Someone got my dad's ear and says, there's places to take your son with problems like that. But I don't think I'm an alcoholic. I agreed to go because I don't want to deal with him. I mean, we were worlds apart. We did not get along. My dad's an alpha male from South Brooklyn. I'm into hippies and hanging out. My hair was down here at the time. My dad should have had a short DA, you know, beating people up a 10. I mean, that's how we wanted to be. And so we just didn't get along. So I went to my first treatment center. I don't know what I'm walking into. I do remember this. It was in Amityville, Long Island. As we're driving up to this private hospital where they have a treatment center, it's a psych hospital. In there, they have a treatment center. It was the same place we took my mom and I went to visit her probably 20 times. There's people in there chasing butterflies in their room. Get it? And then there's a treatment center. And we're both just as, the addicts and alcohol, just as lonely as people chasing butterflies in their room. And there I am for 28 days. I remember Mr. Tough Guy from Brooklyn walks in, and so after the assessment, what does, I go to my room and cry. The counselor comes and says, what's the matter, honey? I don't know why I'm here. And I'm crying, like a five-year-old. Because that's really who I was. You can dress me up. Back then, put on good clothes, give me muscles, give me whatever, and I'm still a five-year-old. And when I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous at 28 years old, I'm operating around an 18-year-old maturity level. I did 28 days in treatment and checked out and got drunk in an hour because that girl I was in the car with when my dad found me. I called her on the payphone in the treatment center, honey, I'm coming home. Like I did 5 years in Attica or something. I was in a private hospital with tennis courts. But you know, I'm coming home. And how was it? It was tough, you know. I like the getting medicated part, doing a detox phase. They medicate. That part was cool. You're just not out. And I got drunk in an hour, and I knew nothing about this road paved to hell called alcoholism. That once I pick up a drink, I need the second drink. And I put the second drink, I need a third drink. I put the third drink and it's all over, I'm drinking. There's no pulling out anymore. And so many times I would go to the liquor store, because I wasn't a big barroom guy, very uncomfortable in bars. I knew it was going to happen to me. I was afraid of getting beat up or thrown out. It was too expensive. I'd rather get a pint and walk the streets, drive in my car, hang out in the hallway, or around other bums like me. That's what I did. But there were so many times I'd go to the liquor store and get a pint of whiskey, and I'm going to nurse this. This will be good. I never nursed anything. And once it was finished, I was back in the liquor store. Then you do this. I can't go to the liquor store. I've been there 3 times today. I find that liquor store. I got to go. And I'm covering the globe, basically. So they think what's going on. Because when you're drunk and black out, you've been there 4 times. You don't even know it. Yeah. It's funny when you walk into a liquor store, and he just puts it on the counter for you. And you think, like, this is pretty cool. He's going full here. You know, you got a problem. This is where I'm at. Now, I'm not even, like, in my 20s yet. Yeah, I got introduced to some other stuff along the way, the narcotics, and I thought I died and went to heaven, and I thought it was going to be a one-time thing, and I ran with that for a few years, the street stuff and alcohol, and I minimized and justified and rationalized as much alcohol as I was drinking, because it's legal. The other stuff is a different kind of life. And I'm very grateful God pulled me out of that. My last couple of years out there was drinking and eating pills, because that would have killed me. I made my second, third, fourth, fifth treatment center. And, you know, going into my fifth treatment center, our book says we had to concede to our innermost self we're alcoholic. Yeah? It also says I'm 100% hopeless apart from divine help. I never knew what that meant until I experienced exactly what they're talking about. Going into my fifth treatment center, I'm way beyond conceit into my, I know what I am. I mean, my arms show it. I got hepatitis C. I cannot stop drinking. I'm done, it's over, and the bottle's finished, and you throw it against a brick wall, but I need one more pint. Well, I got to stop drinking, so let me get a pint to figure out how not to do this anymore. And it's just nonstop. I will tell you, from my first treatment center to my last one, I was not a guy with 30 days or 60 days or 90 days in AA. From my first treatment center to my last one in 1988, unless I was in treatment, I was either drunk or in the pursuit of getting drunk. There was no sober time for me. The most I accumulated was after my fifth treatment center, ironically my longest stay in treatment up until that point, which was 9 weeks. Going into my fifth treatment center, I know exactly what I am, and I'm swearing off everything. The street stuff and the alcohol's gotta stop. This is crazy. My family wants nothing to do with me. No woman in her right mind would even come in my area code. I had a job as a longshoreman, a job that was impossible to lose. We were probably the second biggest union in the country. I got fired from that job, and you couldn't get fired from that job. I got fired. And said, my dad says, you're fired. Don't come to work anymore. And there was no strike, by the way. They just went business as usual. But going in there, I know I'm in serious, serious trouble. And they hold on to me for 9 weeks. And after 9 weeks, I look relatively healthy upon discharge date. I got color back in my face. I'm bathing. I'm shaving. Going to groups. I'm going to the gym. I look like a normie out there. And on the way out, I told him I know what I need to do. And I crossed the threshold onto the street in Amityville, Long Island. And I'm slack with reality. All the voices, you know the voices we walk around all day long, they're always talking, like even doing a meeting. Like when it's a go around and I finish speaking, I'm going this way, and the guy in the end's figuring out his speech while you're speaking. It's always working. What are we eating? Tomorrow at work, next month, next Christmas, I'm going to have enough money to buy stuff. And this is all day long, before later on. Well, as soon as I hit the streets, it was like, boom, it all woke up. All the voices. And I quickly noticed on a Saturday morning in Amityville, Long Island, people are going about their business like most people on a Saturday, chores and things, and no one really cared. I just got out of treatment. And I feel the anxiety and the uncomfortability and the fear, and it's already hurting. Life is really uncomfortable. I liked it better in there. I couldn't wait to get out. Now that I'm out, I kind of wish I was back in there. It was comfortable. They told me where to go, what to do, what to say, you know, had my own bed and all this other stuff. Now I'm on my own. I don't know what to do. And one boy says, we need a drink now. need to get a drink right now, just take the edge off. Can't get a drink, get a bump, get a pill, get some, just take the edge off, and then we're going to go to AA. But right now, the belly's upside down, the chest is vibrating, my forehead is sweating, we need a drink, just one drink. This is the lie. And I buy the lie, and the truth gets me all the time. See, for me, drinking and sober, the truth will always find me. I can't outrun the truth, which is I'm alcoholic. I could try to deny that all day long, live in delusion all day long. The truth will find me. The same thing when I'm doing things that aren't spiritual, and I try to justify them as it's okay, the truth will find me. Well, I will wake up with a huge emotional hangover, remorse, regret, embarrassment, humiliation, or divorce papers. The truth will always find me. And as an alcoholic, a double vodka will find me if I'm not careful. A bottle of Jack will find me if I'm not careful. It'll come in money, a lot or a little. It'll come in a relationship, a wonderful or breakup. It'll just show up. The truth will always find me. There's a great phrase I love, the truth will set you free. Know the truth and the truth will set you free. Huh? Know the truth and the truth will set you free. There's a lot of truths in life. Death and taxes, we all learned that one. You got to pay tax or you go to jail, and we're all going to pass. I need food in my body because if I don't, I get sick and wither away. I need to keep hydrated to a certain point. If not, I get sick and wither away. Those are real truths. I need a roof over my head. Another truth. But what is the truth? What truth do we talk about? It says, know the truth, and the truth will set me free. What truth are we talking about? Only one truth, the truth, Him. I get right with Him, and everything seems to just be okay. I am experiencing freedom. I can get locked into the mechanics of the big book and forget about the freedom it promises. Me, I'd rather live in the freedom than be an AA big book lawyer. And the mechanics are important to me, but I'd rather live in the freedom. What does that relationship look like? There's a gentleman I listen to a lot, and he's a bishop, and he says, how would it be from the moment you open your eyes to the moment you close your eyes during the day, if God was standing right next to you in everything you did that day, would you be comfortable? Because, you know, sometimes we do stuff, God's not listening, God's not paying attention. On that particular day after my first treatment session, I went home to my dad's house. There's nowhere else to go. And I stayed there. And because there was nowhere else to go. Not that I wanted to go. I didn't want to be in his grasp. I didn't want to be anywhere near my dad. And I joke about this, but if my dad could have put a leash on me to keep me tied down in the house, to keep me from hurting me, I think he would have. Everyone in my family knew I was a danger to me. Me, I'm a danger to me. I'm the greatest enemy. I'm better off fighting a guy 6'5", 250, because after he beats me up, it's over. Not my alcoholism. It just keeps hitting. And I snuck out of the house on a Monday morning because I could not take living there anymore, and I could not take the loudness in the head. I need a drink. I need a drink. I got to get out of here. I can't sleep. I can't eat. I can't even carry on a conversation. I need a drink. This is crazy. Called white knuckle sobriety. Imagine doing that in AA, month after month, year after year, bad relationship after bad relationship, job after job, going through 45 sponsors in the first 90 days, you know, 46 home groups in a year. The common thread through all of it is me. I remember there was a few of us sitting with my old sponsor. And one of them said, I keep meeting these crazy women. My whole life, I keep meeting crazy women. And my sponsor says, well, maybe they are crazy, but who keeps picking them? You. It's a common thread, it's me. On Monday morning, I snuck out with one of the cars at my dad's house, my brother's car. In reality, what I did was I stole my brother's car. I didn't tell him I'm borrowing it. It was like 5 in the morning, took the keys, got in the car. My plan was to drive to South Brooklyn. I was living in Staten Island, New York at the time with my dad. And I was going to drive to South Brooklyn. I think it's on Henry Street, right near the BQE. And it was a liquor store I'd go to a lot. I was going to get, here's the plan. It was to set up the ambush. I'm going to get one pint of whiskey. It's Monday, which means by the time I'll be going opposite traffic. Everyone's heading to work. It's going to be just great. Pint of whiskey between my legs, drinking a pint, driving back. I'll get in, no one will know. I'll send one out to the store for a few minutes, and I'll be nice for the day. I get there, it's 5 o'clock in the morning, nothing's open. I'm pacing up and down the sidewalk, waiting for the liquor store owner to get there. And this is when I meet my demons. I've shared this a million times. Because I believe we all have to meet our demons at some point. It's way beyond conceding to our animals. So we kind of step out and have this out-of-body experience. It's exactly what is I'm up against and what I've turned into. The obsession, as I'm walking up and down the sidewalk, the obsession is so powerful, it begins to feel physical. I feel like I'm going through withdrawal. I'm not. But after 9 weeks of being in treatment, there's nothing wrong with my body. It's as sober as it's ever going to be. But my belly's hurting, my chest is shaking, and I'm thinking, I really need a drink. I need one drink. I really need a drink. And I finally get in there, buy a pint of whiskey. I never made it to the car. I sucked that down as fast as I could. And you know what happened? I need a second pint of whiskey. Because alcoholism doesn't care how long I'm sober. Alcoholism is alcoholism. So I buy a second pint of whiskey. Thank God I have the money. I never made it to the car because after I finish two pints of whiskey, I'm drunk. So when I'm drunk, I like to get drunker. And when I'm really drunk, I like to eat pills. And just get oblivious. I don't want to feel life. It hurts. It's uncomfortable. And in sobriety, life can still be, it's still problematic. It still hurts. It still feels unfair. It's still full of a lot of toxic stuff. And I need some muscles to navigate through all of that, to travel light, to wear the world like a loose garment, rather than heavy and full of contempt and anger. Because that starts to come out in thought, word, and deed. There's something that says the mouth speaks what the heart is full of. That starts to come out. And I want to put it back in. I can't believe I just said that to someone. And I wound up going on one of the worst drugs. I got arrested a couple of times. Just a bad, bad time. And the trap doors have trap doors. And I landed in my sixth treatment center and walked out after 36 hours. Because I knew this was a scam I'm running. It'll never happen. Sobriety will never happen for me. In fact, I didn't even know why I was born. And I hated God for bringing me to this planet. It was one big mistake. I despised myself, what I had turned into. I knew my family despised me for what I had turned into. I cursed myself, as Bill says, for being a weakling. I couldn't do it anymore. I wanted out. I wanted to die. Really, I wanted out. And I remember eating what was left of a bottle of Valium and washing it down with Jack in some Fleabag motel in Staten Island, New York, and waited to die. And at that moment, I remember thinking, there was this little flash of reality that this is exactly what my mom experienced. Because alcohol, that's what it does. Dying is the way out now. And we don't want to die permanently. We want to die for a little while and come back when everything's cool and it started again. But I wanted out. And God kept interrupting my death because he had his story for me to live. Or a story for me to live, I should say. I couldn't see that then. I was dead to God in my mind, but very much awake to him, very much alive to him. And he kept throwing those life rafts out. And through desperation, on June 23rd, 1988, where the desperation finally screamed louder than the ego. You know when that happened. See, when the desperation screams louder than the ego, there's no need to hit any more bottoms. We talk about the bottoms we hit. The ego responds, this is a bottom, I need to do something, then I get some air back in my lungs and I keep going. When the ego kind of gets crushed for a moment, there's no need for a bottom anymore. And in that place, for me, there was no, I need to go to AA, I need to go to treatment, I need to go to detox, I need to get a sponsor. None of this was anywhere in the horizon. It was, please take me from this, I don't want to die. It was out of options. It was a God seed that was planted. No self-reliance, no trying to figure out, I don't know what to do. I just don't want to die. And that's a place called getting surrendered. I'm very oblivious. I got to get sober and go to AA. First, I'll go to treatment. I go to detox first. That'll probably be about 5 days. They'll put me in treatment. I'll come out, go to AA, get a sponsor, go through the steps, and turn into Moses. This will be great. I don't know what to do. I just don't want to die. And it's interesting, in a true surrender place, how all the dots get connected, and I wake up to the dots being connected. Whether it happens right then or down the road, because we live life forward and understand it backwards. And my dad found me standing on a street corner in Lower Manhattan. He made a drive from Atlantic City, New Jersey to Lower Manhattan. That's a long drive without traffic. And found me standing on a street corner, and I was taken out of that scrap heap, if you will, really rescued at that point and placed in my 7 treatment center. Something happened. Albeit 10 days in there, my mind was not done with me. It was romancing one more drink. See, that stays with me for a while. I love the analogy you got. You come out of Publix and you put the packages on your front seat, and you slam on your brakes at a red light, the car comes to stop, the groceries keep going. Well, because I'm in treatment, the mind keeps going. And 10 days I'm thinking, I overreact, I need to get a drink, and I'll come back to AA. That didn't happen. And they sent me to Minnesota, and then something, it was a shift that I have nothing to do with. You know, when I pray, it's, no matter how hard I pray or how sincere I pray, how much surrender is involved in that, I can't commence the Spirit to do anything. It's God. What I am is positioned to be changed by Him. I didn't plug into a battery last night to last me, you know, the whole day, like with the cell phone. I don't plan on breathing. It just happens. The heart's just beating. It's the same thing with this transformation. And there was a shift, because I remember when I was in Minnesota in more treatment, halfway, three-quarter in sober living, and going to some of these meetings, and this one particular meeting called the Three Legacies meeting, the shift was, I need to get with you. I saw pictures of Bill and Bob. I didn't even know who they were. But they were dressed nice. And this one meeting, people dressed nice. And they seemed elegant and articulate and had some grace and dignity. And they'd go to the diner and talk about life, but they did it with grace and dignity. I knew it was something very special, Alcoholics Anonymous. I call it sacred now. I didn't have that adjective back then. I know it's sacred. It's holy ground when I walk into an AA meeting. And I get to take this out there, which is much more important. To the hour in here, but I knew I need to get with you guys, because I can't do this anymore. I wear my brother's 8.5 sneaker, I'm a 10 shoe. I'm wearing his clothes that I can just squeeze into because I have nothing. And I'm embarrassed to walk around, but that's all I got. And God kept me close to the ground, a force feeding of humility. I didn't have credit cards, and there was no cell phones. I had a car that wasn't liquid, I had money in my pocket, I had zero. And my dad listened to the counselors who said, keep him that way. Don't start sending him money. He'll be fine. I work in a treatment center. Because these cats come in with credit cards, phones, and they want stuff. You want stuff. I do sometimes intakes. Phones in a treatment center are a deal breaker. You're not ready. Because if it was me, I would have sold the phone. I mean, you know. But that's where I was. And I'm happy to report to you the good news that God has kept me here. At the risk of sounding boastful, because I'm not trying to be that way, a member of good standing. I couldn't be anything else in Alcoholics Anonymous. This is that important to me. It is my life. AA. God has given me, taken me from a selfless, self-seeking, self-absorbed, self-centered, a self, to on most days, selfless. And a servant's heart. And I'm no better than anyone in this room. I didn't have a college education. I'm not that educated guy who could figure this out. I'm really grateful about that. So I chop wood and carry water. And I get to talk about the good news. I pray our friend Russell gets better quick. We need him around. I thank you for listening. That's all I got. Peace.